Good afternoon and welcome to Open Air, KLW's radio magazine of the performing arts. I'm your host, David LaTulipe. This week I'll be talking with actor Jackson Davis, who plays one of the lead characters in the current production of Native Gardens, a cutting-edge suburban comedy from National Latino Playwriting Award winner Karen Zacharias. It's at Theater Works Silicon Valley through September 16th. On location at the San Francisco War Memorial Opera House, my recent visit with Italian conductor Riccardo Frizza to discuss his upcoming performances of Donizetti's Roberto Devereux at the opera. From the San Francisco Chronicle, we'll catch up with classical music critic Joshua Cosman, who gives us his preview of the new music season in the Bay Area. And Open Air's regular contributor and critic at large, Peter Robinson, interviews writer and journalist Mary Jo McConaughey about her upcoming book, The Tango War, The Struggle for the Hearts, Minds, and Riches of Latin America During World War II. Stay with us. Strains of Stravinsky to start off this episode of Open Air here on KLW. For Stravinsky figures prominently in the fall performing arts scene, and here to talk about not only Stravinsky but things that are to be highlighted in your date book is the date book's recent contributor for the fall arts preview for the San Francisco Chronicle, the music critic of the San Francisco Chronicle, Joshua Cosman. Josh, welcome to our afternoon airwaves.
Yes, thanks.
We are
it's a pleasure to be here.
Frequent guest on Sunday evening for as a panelist for Minds Over Matter, but it's nice to see you during the daylight.
Well, thank you very much. It's nice to be here.
We should acknowledge that not everyone is a Chronicle subscriber, but we should point out that last Sunday's Pink Pages, which is called the Datebook section, featured all of the critics offering what they're looking forward to in the various cultural stages in the weeks to come in the fall arts preview. If you haven't picked it up, I think you can still find a copy somewhere. So don't feel like you have to necessarily avoid what you just talked about in the Chronicle.
No, I was going to say, we've got material for those who already read it in the Pink section and some other stuff that isn't in there
to encourage them to subscribe, perhaps.
Exactly.
There we go.
Exactly.
Support
exactly
your local newspaper.
So, yeah, as you say, Stravinsky is going to be figuring rather prominently this fall, starting with the San Francisco Symphony, which is going to, after the Fall de Rale of the gala opening concert with Itzhak Perlman, is going to get into a two-week Stravinsky festival with Michael Tilson Thomas conducting. This will be some of the greatest hits and some of the less well-known pieces, including the three great early ballets that Stravinsky wrote for the Ballet Russe, and then also the Violin Concerto and Persephone.
Who's playing the Violin Concerto, you recall? We'll look that up.
I had it a minute ago. And
that's all right. We'll check.
What's
there.
Ray Chen.
Thank you very much.
Thanks, Neil Swinkles. On the ball with that.
Thank you, Neil. Ray Chen is exactly who it is.
We'll be on the show later.
That's
super.
That's a good thing. And, of course, it's always interesting to hear the symphony, to hear Michael Tilson Thomas play Stravinsky. It's hard to hear him play it and not think about the fact that he came up in Los Angeles sort of learning at the master's knee.
True
not
enough.
About these early pieces so much as the later pieces that Stravinsky was writing in Los Angeles, the 12-tone and other kinds of modernist pieces that he was writing during his last years in Los Angeles. But I think, you know, there's a certain kind of cachet and a certain kind of insight that a conductor gets from having known the composer and worked with him and learned, you know, from him and hung around with him. If nothing else, you get lots of good anecdotes to tell the orchestra and during rehearsal and the audience at the beginning of the concert.
I hope those are being preserved somehow, other than in a future Michael Tilson-Bondi book. It'd be nice to hear some anecdotes.
I'm sure the keepers are being, you know, preserved, and a lot of the other ones. Much of their charm comes from the ephemeral nature of his telling. He's a good storyteller when he gets going.
Well, Stravinsky not only being done by the San Francisco Symphony, but Gergiev is coming to town in October.
Right.
No collusion involved, I believe.
No.
All right.
But with the Marinsky Orchestra, and there'll be some Stravinsky on that, and even before that, we've got the San Francisco performances season starting on September 28th with a really interesting-looking program of devoted to a jazz version of Stravinsky's early fable, the history, L'Histoire du Soldat, the soldier's tale. That's going to have Sean Jones and Regina Carter playing as a kind of a gala for the San Francisco performances season opener. I'm looking forward to that and all of the other Stravinsky that's coming down the road, because you can't get too much Stravinsky.
Indeed. Especially in this year, of course.
Yeah.
And let's back up a bit to the San Francisco Symphony. Mm-hmm. Michael Tilson-Thomas, not quite his swan song year.
No.
But we're anticipating him eventually stepping down from the podium and, of course, being there as conductor laureate for many years to come. Any thoughts about who you'd like to see in that spot?
Those shoes are going to be incredibly hard to fill, and I think part of what needs to happen in that place is that they need to find someone who's, you know, got some of the same attributes that he has, that kind of easy communication with the audience and with the subscribers and with the orchestra, and at the same time a kind of a different approach so that it doesn't, you know, so that we don't get somebody who just feels like MTT warmed over.
Right.
Who that person is, I wish I knew.
You've been on the scene a little longer than I have in terms of the San Francisco Symphony. Has there been that much of a cultural identity between conductor and orchestra with previous conductors? And you think that's going to be a challenge for?
Well, that's a very good question. There hasn't been, but partly because, you know, Michael's been there 25 years and has hired, I don't know the numbers, but it must be at least half the orchestra, and has certainly put his stamp on the playing and the style and the sound of that orchestra in a way that no other conductor has had a chance to do. So whoever comes in is going to find that it's, you know, Michael's orchestra, for better and for worse, in terms of, you know, their desire to put their own identity on it.
Speaking of his being involved in the personnel, there are a couple of announcements that were recently made with the symphony that Robin Sutherland will be retiring.
Yes,
this year,
and that'll be
after 40 years.
45. No, 45.
45.
Yeah, no, he started in 73. He was 22 years old. A fresh-faced kid out of the San Francisco Conservatory of Music, and they brought him in as a last-minute replacement for somebody who had fallen sick, and he did so well that they took him on tour to play the Ives Fourth Symphony. And if you know that piece, there's this ginormous piano solo, which is very difficult, and he just apparently sailed through it and shone greatly. And Seiji Ozawa, who was then the music director of the orchestra, said, well, we need to make a place for this guy. Mm. And so that was the first time that the orchestra had had an actual, you know, on-staff, full-time pianist. So it's going to be a big loss and another hard position to fill, I think.
Mm-hmm. Also, two new members of the orchestra, Wyatt Underhill will be the new assistant concertmaster, and Aaron Schumann will be joining as associate principal trumpet.
Yep.
We should mention that the symphony does get underway next Wednesday with their gala opening concert. Usually some pretty softball stuff, but this time with the legendary Itzhak Perlman as the bait. And an interesting program. He's going to be doing some pop favorites, of course, including what he made famous, the theme from Schindler's List of John Williams, some other film music from Cinema Paradiso and Scent of a Woman and Out of Africa. But interesting also, the Bach Concerto No. 3 for two violins, strings, and continuo, which Perlman will be joined by students of his Perlman music program for a special unique presentation of
that. So that'll be a nice way of kind of giving a full range of the possibilities of that kind of an event, because it's always a problem of, you know, you don't want to give them Bruckner 4th on opening night because everyone... No, I won't go there.
Okay, well, they are giving them a couple of Gershwin hits, though.
Yeah, there you
Cuban
go.
Overture, which is a great virtuosic piece in American in Paris.
Yeah, so that'll be good. And the symphony, of course, is not the only organization. Well, coming back to, before we finish that, I want to just point out that, you know, Michael's got all of this season and the next season, and at that point they're going to have to name a replacement for him, or by that point, I should say. So what it suggests is that the every guest appearance by any guest conductor in the next 2 years
could be the
We really
need
always
been carefully calculated.
We need to regard this as an audition, right? Everybody's assumed to be auditioning unless proven otherwise.
I mean, any thoughts? American, female, Russian? Perhaps Russian.
It would be wonderful to see a woman take over there. I mean, that's always been, of course, a very notable failing, not only for this orchestra but for pretty much every orchestra in the country, aside from the Baltimore Symphony. The positions of power or on the podium, not so much in the boardroom, but the music directorships are all held by men. Susanna Malki, the great Finnish conductor, has had some wonderful guest appearances here. That doesn't seem like it would be a bad decision. If you talk to anybody in the field, the person that they're most excited about is the Lithuanian conductor, whose name is, let me see if I can do this because I'm going to try and get in practice. She's coming in February. Wait a minute. I had it written.
You had it.
I had it queued up on my phone here, and then I lost it. Mirga Grazinita Tila, but it's easier just to say MGT.
Oh.
And you see, if they hire her, then it's just a one-letter change.
They could just do some whiteout.
Exactly.
It'd be perfect.
Exactly. Yeah. So, you know, it's never out of place to look at the budget savings that you can get by doing that.
Interesting podium changes a foot across the street as well.
Exactly. So Nicola Luizzotti, the music director, is now gone, and now they're operating for some indeterminate number of years without an actual person in that position. Just like at the symphony, pretty much every conductor that we see this fall and again in the summer is, you know, let's assume that person is conducting an audition for us, for the general director Matthew Schilvach, for the staff and the orchestra and everybody, and there's an enormous influx of guest conductors this year, of debuting conductors, I should say. That is to say, out of the eight operas, I think something like six of them are being conducted by people who are making their company debuts.
Mm-hmm.
So that will give us a lot of a good sense of what kind of talent there is out there and who they might be looking at.
Well, one of the people on the podium for the San Francisco Opera is a return conductor, and that would be Ricardo Frizza, who you'll hear from later this hour in my pre-recorded interview. And it includes, as part of your hot picks, his conducting of Donizetti's Roberto Devereux.
Yeah, which is going to be the second night offering on Saturday, the 8th, I guess, of September. So this is, you know, this is one of the historical operas about the Tudor courts. This is the famous three operas about the Donizetti, the Tudor queens. And it's one that has not been done here since 1979. And that was the only time it's ever been done. So it's a rarity. It's going to be kind of fun. I think we can speak in all frankness and say I personally am not a great fan of Donizetti's music. Mm-hmm. I find it a little bit thin, except when it's done really well.
Mm.
So I am really looking forward to this production because, primarily because Maestro Fritze will have at his disposal a really terrific trio of principal singers, the soprano Sandra Radvanovsky, tenor Russell Thomas, and the mezzo-soprano Jamie Barton. It's kind of a getting the band together and what's that?
Putting on a show.
Getting them back on the road. This is the same trio of principals who sang in Norma in 2014, mm-hmm. and that was an absolutely knockdown production. Radvanovsky and Jamie Barton are a tremendous duo. They work very well together, and Russell Thomas did very well in that production as well. So I think that's going to carry. I'm expecting that's going to carry me over my
hesitation. All right.
Scott Donizetti, yes.
And again, you'll hear more about that production from the conductor himself, Ricardo Fritze, later this hour, and his longtime association with Radvanovsky. Now, I know we're talking about things to come, but we should back up a moment. As you mentioned, it's nice to get to hear about exciting productions, and we both came across one the other day in some unexpected Wagner, didn't we?
Yes, wasn't that something?
The Charles Heder Foundation.
Yeah, Claude Heder Foundation. So, yeah, Claude Heder was a well-known operatic Heldentenor in the 50s and 60s, a Bay Area native, born in Oakland and now lives in San Francisco. And when I first started at the paper in the late 80s, he had rejuvenated or revived a company called the Oakland Opera that put on some productions back over in the I think it might have been I can't remember where it was, but but you know, he's got a long history here, and this is a production that the Claude Heder Foundation, which seems to have popped up out of nowhere, run by some of his students and with his help and encouragement. And it's not the kind of thing you expect to run across. It's like the first thing we're going to do is put on a concert production of Wagner's Tristan and Isolde. And so I think I had some healthy skepticism about it going in. But it really was a surprising success. And, I mean, some of the singers we knew, the bass, Philip Skinner, who's been a stalwart of the San Francisco Opera and in general the Bay Area opera scene for 20, 30 years now. He sang King Marco, but the principals were not known to me, and everybody did a terrific job. It was an unexpected delight.
Right?
Didn't you find? I didn't realize you were there. I only caught
the first act because I had to go to work.
Oh, well.
I missed the best stuff. Anyway, let's go on with just a couple minutes we have about mm-hmm. some of your other highlights that you're looking forward to.
Well, one of the things that's happening this year, for reasons that no one can quite explain or understand, is that we're going to get a lot of Bach cello suites. You know, I mean, it's not that often that a cellist will – I mean – every cellist plays the Bach suite sooner or later, but it's a little rarer to hear people do all six of them in one program. It's a little bit of a long program that way, and it takes a toll on them, and it requires a great deal of concentration from the audience. This year we are having not one, not two, but three full, complete Bach cello suites, I'm greatly looking forward to this. I can't tell you how excited mm-hmm. I am. The first one, of course, is the great Yo-Yo Ma, who will be playing at the Greek Theater, presented by Cal Performances on September 30th. And then a month later in Herbst Theater from San Francisco Performances, this is on the 28th of October, the French cellist Jean-Guyen Queyras. I hope I'm pronouncing that right. I don't know. So these will be sort of back-to-back. And then come May, Elisa Weilerstein will be returning to do it a third time. So that's a total of 18 cello suites, if you're really kind of making the spreadsheet and want to compare and contrast. The Greek Theater seems like a strange place for one guy and a cello. The thing to remember is that he played the Bach suites in the Hollywood Bowl maybe about a year ago, and, you know, grown men wept, and jaded music critics wrote enormous gushing paeans to the grand. I mean, people who were there seemed to have felt that it was the event of a lifetime. So I want some of that.
Yeah, me too. Quickly, another highlight or two as we hear a little bit of Bach in the background. Yeah.
Well, one of the things that I'm particularly interested in is the West Eastern Divan Orchestra, which is this orchestra that the cellist, the pianist rather, and conductor Daniel Barenboim put together, which combines Israeli and Palestinian musicians in a single ensemble. That organization is coming to Berkeley in November for the first time, thanks to Cal Performances.
Nice. And we should mention, speaking of podiums, that there is a new conductor on the Santa Rosa Symphony podium.
Yes.
Music director Francesco Lecce Chong.
Yes, about whom I know nothing, but I'm looking forward to hearing what he can do.
New Century Chamber Orchestra has some wonderful things ahead. We'll have to have you back to talk about more.
I'm always at your disposal, David. Thank you so much.
Thanks,
for having
Joshua.
Me.
Jake Cosman at sfchronicle.com if you'd like to offer your own tidbits of interest to Josh. Thanks for coming on.
Thank you.
Music of Yo-Yo Ma playing Bach, which you'll hear later this season. Yo-Yo Ma, a little taste of the Bach cello suites from the first suite in G major. September 30th at the Greek Theater, UC Berkeley campus for that performance. Thank you again to Joshua Cosman for offering a couple of quick picks for the fall season ahead. Again, if you have the Pink Pages from this Sunday, some great detail about what he's on what he's recommending. Well, the timely topic of border disputes continues the 2018-19 season of TheatreWorks Silicon Valley, but this conflict is more on the local level, and no children are harmed in this production, and the invective is tempered by comedy. When an up-and-coming Latino couple purchases a home in a sought-after neighborhood beside the prize-winning garden of a prominent Washington, D.C. family, conflicts over fences and flora spiral into a clash of cultures, exposing both couples' notions of race, taste, class, and privilege. Here to talk about the production of Native Gardens is one half of the two power couples that appear on stage. Jackson Davis has starred in a number of TheatreWorks productions and was recently seen in the world premiere of Lynn Kaufman's Two Minds at the Marsh in San Francisco. He's also appeared at the ACT stages, Marin Theater Company, San Francisco Playhouse, San Jose Rep, and others. Jackson, a pleasure to welcome you to Open Air.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be with you today.
So you're half of one of the power couples. Let's talk about your character.
Well, it's not the Latino couple. my character is the kind of the prime force behind the garden that has been planted, that he has been nurturing for a long while. He seems to be consulting from home. I'm not sure how that may have developed, but his wife is an engineer at Lockheed, a longtime engineer at Lockheed. As she said, she's been there so long she has her own bathroom. in any case, it's an interesting piece, and I have to tell you kind of how I got the role. I'm not sure that this led to it, but a friend of mine, Maureen McVerry, who's playing in this wonderful production of Sunday in the Park with George. I think it only has a few more performances at the SF Playhouse. It's really wonderful. But she had been doing a show at TheatreWorks, and she called me one day and she said, they've just given me a side to read, and I can't do it because I'm doing this other show, but this is your story. You got to audition for that. It's because I've been going through a property dispute myself for about 2 or 3 years. And for any of you who have ever done that or know somebody, it's not pleasant. So I immediately read the script, and I thought, yeah, this is something I can relate to.
Apparently that's the inspiration from Karen Zacharias. She was looking for a theme for writing the play, and she talked at a dinner party. Like, everyone seemed to have a neighbor,
exactly.
neighbor
it's,
dispute.
It's kind of one of those things that you don't you feel kind of special about until you start talking to people and you realize that it is not something you ever want to get into, but sometimes it's forced upon you. But this is a comic treatment, and it turns out it turns things upside down too. When I had first started to read the play, I read the first couple of pages and I thought, no, this is a pleasant play about, you know, a white couple and a Latino couple. And then when I found out that there was this border dispute, I really read through the play, and it's interesting how the roles get reversed. It's something that the playwright has done that I think is very skillful in upending your expectations about who's going to say what, about politically correct things or not come out of everybody's mouth at one time or another. And it's been very fun so far to play it and to hear the responses from the audience, as they have been, you know, varied. You know, you might have one audience of gardeners one day and then, you know, more politically astute audiences the next. But there's something for everybody, and it's really jam-packed.
So what is the conflict that we're going to be seeing perform on stage?
Well, it turns out that this couple had always thought was their property, the established couple living there, turns out that that had been incorrect, and that when the new family moved into a house that had been rented for, I mean, had been the property of another couple for so long, and then when they died, a stepson took over, and he'd rented it to these, you know, AU students and what have you. Well, finally, this other couple buys the house, and they have, especially the female half of that couple has designs on a kind of garden that she wants to have, a native garden filled with plants that are indigenous to that area. And as you might expect, my garden is filled with hydrangeas and the English ivy and Bermuda grass and all of the things that she says are not, you know, not the greatest for that area, and they don't attract the right bugs and bees, et cetera. And
you've been there longer, and so your feathers are immediately ruffled.
Yes, exactly. So when they do, in fact, have, because they're going to build a fence, because her husband is going to have a party for his law firm that he's just joined, they realize that when they start measuring things out, that they, in fact, have more land than they had expected, given the fence that was up. So when they decide that they want to build a new fence, and where it's going to go becomes
a
hot topic.
Does who pay for it comes in?
Actually, you know, that is perhaps the one item that she leaves out of the equation. Although when the Latino husband starts to bring up the topic and discuss about the discrepancy, I think my character begins to think that he's going to talk about money and, you know, is not so good. But then it turns out to be, in fact, he's talking about land. And so there is some talk about maybe buying the land from him, so that's where the money part comes in, but it's just a very little bit. It's actually just about whose land this is and who has the right to it and squatters' rights and all of these topics that get involved.
Jackson Davis with Amy Resnick is the power couple, Frank and Virginia Butley, up against Michael Evans Lopez and Marlene Martinez as the new neighbors in this Washington, D.C. border dispute, Native Gardens by Karen Zacharias. Regional premiere, award-winning playwrights, really making its voice heard around the country in different theaters.
Yes, it's been done. It's been done in many, many, many theaters.
Theater Works, that's theater with an R-E, theaterworks.org for more information. Jackson, thanks for coming in today.
Thanks for having me.
Of course.
Bye-bye.
Well, one of the aforementioned highlights from Joshua Cosman and coming to a stage near you is the San Francisco opera production of Gaetano Donizetti's Roberto Devereux. I talked with the conductor, Ricardo Frizzi, the other day at the Opera House. Here's that conversation. Maestro Frizzi, welcome to Open Air.
Thank you. Thank you for the invitation.
Of course. This will be your fourth appearance with your San Francisco opera, working once again with the wonderful Sandro Radvanovsky again in this production as the lead role of Elizabeth I. She sang the role at the Met back in 2016, and you've worked with her quite a bit.
Yes, I worked many times with her. And I did also one of the three queens, It's called The Three Queens of Donizetti at the Met. Actually, we did Maria Stuarda together in going back to the 2006 season.
And she's being considered almost a successor to Callas in her interpretations of the Italian repertoire.
Well, she's a very intense singer. First of all, because she has experience now, but she's coming from a different repertoire. So now, usually she's singing all the bel canto, the Queens, Norma. But before she did Tosca, the old Verdi. So she's able to put the big drama of the late 19th century in the early 19th century, because the weight of the drama is not different. The music is different. The feeling is the same. So the power of the music is the same. It's only a matter of style. And she has this beautiful voice, so beautiful and long breath, great range. So she's able to touch the high D until the low G. So super extension. And that permit her to go through this difficult singing, because I would like to say that the singing bel canto is much, much difficult than singing Tosca, for example.
Mm-hmm. For those that are unfamiliar with the historic character Robert Devereux, or the second Earl of Essex, and his relationship with Queen Elizabeth I, what do we need to know to prepare for this opera as we see the operatic treatment of this historic story?
Well, this is very interesting, because Donizetti, even the opera is called Roberto Devereux, is not the main character. The main character is Elizabeth I. But Donizetti, with the librettista, we call the people that write the libretto, Salvatore Camarano, they decided to put him in a different position. So he comes on stage always because he's called on stage. So dramaturgically, he is not a cavatina, so the presentation hair that usually every singers, every principal character has in bel canto, for example. Everybody remember Castadiva. Castadiva is the presentation of Norma. Or, I don't know, in Lucia, there is the first aria, is the first cavatina, so every character is presented by an aria. Roberto, no. Is arriving as a third character in the stage. Even is the title role, Roberto Devereux. What is different is that before Donizetti wrote this opera, another composer in Italy wrote the Count of Essex, Saverio Mercadante. Roberto is still a tenor, but he has the principal character. Donizetti tried a different way. So Elizabeth has to be the first and principal character. Everybody has to know that, have to learn very well the story, because it's quite complicated. Even it's quite, I would like to say, it's almost practically the same as the original story, the real history, but just the end is different, because in Roberto Devereux, in some way they have to finish the opera. And Donizetti chose to Elizabeth abdicate in favor of James I. That is not true in history. But it's just because she has to pass with somebody the reign, so they decided to do that. Historically, it's going very well, because the relation between characters is original. The relation between Sarah and Nottingham, they got married, but Sarah is in love with Roberto, but Roberto is in love with... it's a complicated love stories, but it's not difficult to follow.
And, of course, we have to look forward to that very final scene of Elisabetta sung. I'm sure it's going to be ravishing by Sandra Radwanowski.
Yes, I think the last aria, the last scene, is one of the most beautiful scenes that Donizetti wrote in his career. And the Three Queens, as we call, even there are four operas that Donizetti wrote about Tudors. There's another one. The first is called Elizabeth in Castello di Kenilworth. But unfortunately, it's not considered with as a Tudor cycle. It's a mistake, it's a musicological mistake. Because as to before, we have to count four operas about Tudors. And anyway, the last aria is the most beautiful piece of the opera. But Donizetti gave the same treatment also to Maria Stuarda with the big preghiera, with the last prayer, and in Bolena. So the three queens, so Anna Bolena, Mary Stuart, and Roberto de Vere, they conclude the opera with the big scene of the Queen Elizabeth.
You are an expert on Donizetti. You're trying to bring some of the other Donizetti operas to the forefront of our audiences in the, all around the world. What do you suppose his fascination with the House of Tudor was, to do four separate operas on this branch of the monarchy?
Which is funny, because any time Donizetti brings a British story, it makes the most beautiful music, if you consider also Lucia di Lammermoor. So probably was fascinated with the United Kingdom. I don't know what happened with him, but I'm sure that the most beautiful music he wrote was about with the English history and British literature. That's for sure.
Mm-hmm. This is a Canadian opera production, pretty traditional, but nonetheless spectacular. Do you prefer traditional stagings of most of this particular repertoire, and can you perhaps share a visual interpretation that was maybe not compatible with what you were ingrained in with the score?
Honestly, I have to say that everything depending about how the character they do interpretation. I don't mind the set. Because if the set is traditional, the thing that they come on stage, the thing they live, is not interesting, even with a modern production. Here in this production, Stephen Lawless did a great job to mark the psychological aspect of the characters. And so Queen Elizabeth is very close to reality, so what we know about her. So Sondra is really trying to be the Queen Elizabeth with her illness, with a mental illness. So we try to put this on stage. This is very interesting. And you can do it both in the modern and in a traditional set. It's important is the relation with them. So once we have there with these aspects, I'm very happy with.
Mm-hmm. In October, you'll be continuing your expertise in the Italian repertoire with Rossini's Semiramide and return to Teatro La Fenice in Venice.
Well, so I have a great legacy, big legacy with the Teatro La Fenice, and it's one of my favorite plays because it's so, first of all, it's very beautiful. Second, because the dimension of the house is perfect for the interpretation of the Italian repertoire. Because we have to remember that the composer, Rossini, for instance, with Semiramide, has been composed for this theater. So for the acoustically, it's perfect for this score. Traviata is the same, has been written for La Fenice. And when you conduct Traviata in La Fenice, you understand perfectly the weight of the orchestra, the weight of the orchestration. This is totally different when you're doing a bigger house or a smaller house. This is a matter that something that is important to consider.
It's hard to consider what opera, if any, was written for the Metropolitan Opera House being so huge.
Well, I have to say that acoustic and Metropolitan Opera is perfect. I think it's the best acoustic in this country because there's a lot of volume in the house, so the sound can expand very well. The orchestra, it's very difficult to have the orchestra covering the singers. Unless you have someone that want to play too loud, or some conductors that really love to have a symphonic sound, for example. But if for me, the first thing always when I'm in the pit is to try to balance the weight of the orchestra with the voices. Mm-hmm. Also because voices are not all the same. We have voices more powerful and other less powerful. So always the sound is sustaining the singing and never the singers try to push to pass over the orchestra, go through the orchestra. That's just complicated.
Mm-hmm. And it's got to be a favorite house for you now, the Met, and you're becoming a regular there. Congratulations.
Oh, thank you very much. Hey.
Tell us a little bit about the inaugural concert at the Donizetti Festival in Bergamo, the city where Donizetti was born in November. You're going to be the artistic director of this festival, and it's inaugurating a new house as well.
Well, and I'm the music director, not the artistic director. Anyway, my missions there are to focus in two or three different things. The first, have a musical and artistic support to the scientific institute, because we have a scientific institute where we study the Donizetti, where we do the new Urtext and critical edition of the scores. So sometimes we love to study a score, to have the original score from the manuscript or the sources we find around the world about Donizetti, and put it on stage and see how they work originally. Because now, after many years, we have many traditions. Also, the vocal score are so many and so different, because at the time, also the recorder, for instance, was changing things, and people was copying the music, was interpreting the Donizetti score. So we try to go to the manuscript and see, and try to put on stage exactly as Donizetti wrote it. This is one of the first point. Second is to try to understand which vocality we need to sing Donizetti. Because, unfortunately, in my opinion, there is a big misunderstanding. So, for example, if you play Puccini, we think we need big voices. If you go back and we go to Rossini, we think that has to be lighter. If you go to Mozart, even lighter. And for me, it's a big mistake, because the century or the historical period does not mean has any relation with the weight of the voice. That is true that the orchestra is going to be bigger during the centuries, but the human voice never changed. Mm-hmm. So probably the voice of Donizetti is not just the light voice that we are used to listen with Lucia or Elisir d'Amore, for instance, but could be different and could be more close to the Verdi voice that we are used today. Actually, here in San Francisco, I'm very pleased and very happy to have two big voices to sing this kind of music, because the drama is so intense that we need powerful voices overall in the middle range. Because, of course, when they go up, it's easier to have voice, but it's in the middle range where Donizetti insists with the parola scenica, so scenic word. And this is very interesting. For example, today we are used to listen Lucia Lillamermoor with a very high soprano, because there is the famous cadenza with the flute. But this is not by Donizetti. It's not written by Donizetti. It's written by another composer for a soprano that was very wonderful with coloratura and high range. But if we sing today Lucia Lillamermoor as Donizetti wrote it, we need a totally different soprano, because the highest note is a B flat. So we have to experiment. We have to try to propose another idea. And the last mission we have, I would like to introduce. Actually, we do introduce from this season, so the festival 2018, is to play Donizetti's music with the original instruments. Because nobody did it. We have now from the 70s, Beethoven, Mozart, even Rossini, all the Baroque music, but nobody is going to the first 40 years of the 19th century. It's more difficult because instruments, overall, the winds are changing. So technique is going to be more modern, it's developing, so we have to find the right instrument of that period. But the pitch is different. Pitch was 432. So the sound of the voice is changing, because it's going a little bit lower in the range. So it could be a little bit more darker, could be less bright. So we try to experiment these things.
So that's going to be in November for the Donizetti Festival, which you also have the opportunity to have you introduce to that audience that rarity that we spoke of earlier, Il Castello di Kenilworth, part of the Tudor series.
Yes, as I told before, Castello di Kenilworth, that is so the name of the opera that Donizetti always thought about. It was never Elisabetta in the Castle of Kenilworth. This is a later transformation of the title, the original title, Castello di Kenilworth. So we proposed this with a new score, and our scientific institute prepared this year. So it will be the first time we do the original score, finally. And I'm very happy because it's the last opera that I miss of the Tudor cycle. And for me, it's important to that the world understand that it's not a trilogy, but it's a fourth opera by on the Tudor subject.
Mm-hmm. And then I understand another specialty of yours lies not necessarily on the podium, but in the kitchen.
Oh, yes. I love to cook. It's one of my passion. And yes, it's something that I start doing when I start to travel, when I start to do this job. So I thought that it wasn't good to go to the restaurant every day, every single day. So I said, okay, to be healthy, I have to cook myself. So I learned it, and I have a big, big passion now. Yes.
Well, here in San Francisco, you may want to go to the restaurants.
Wow, there's so many good restaurants in this area, yes. Also very, very good Italian restaurants, so many. I found it, and I love it.
Openings next Saturday evening, curtain times of 7:30, six performances of Donizetti's Roberto Devereaux. We look forward to seeing these performances here in the Opera House, and I understand you're going to be with us for the Opera in the Park, too.
Yes, we one of the conductor of this concert that always San Francisco Opera is doing for the city, so we're very happy to be part of that. Thank you.
Thanks for your time, and we'll see you there.
Thank you. Thank you.
Here's the great Sandra Radvanovsky from that final act of Donizetti. Having learned of her beloved Robert's execution, she sings, "That spilled blood rises to heaven, demanding justice, calls for vengeance, no mercy. At your final moment, turn to God. Perhaps he'll be able to pardon you." Sandra Radvanovsky in that Met production excerpt. You'll hear it on the San Francisco Opera stage next week. Opera season does get underway just 2 days after the Symphony's Gala festivities next Wednesday. On Friday, the gowns will be on full view for the season's opening production, or rather productions, of Cavalleria Rusticana and Pagliacci, rarely heard separately, music by Pietro Mascagni and Ruggero Leoncavallo, respectively. Not seen with the San Francisco Opera for some 15 years, and in a production new to San Francisco Opera, with Daniele Caligari making his guest conducting debut with the company. That's Friday. Saturday, the opening of Roberto Devereaux by Donizetti, which you just heard about from conductor Riccardo Frizza. And Sunday, always great fun. It's the San Francisco Opera in the Golden Gate Park at the Robin Williams Meadow, recently named Robin Williams Meadow. Opera in the Park starting at 1:30. Hope to see you there. A different taste now with Peter Robinson in studio with a live guest. Hey, Peter, take it away.
Yeah, well, I think what we're hearing, David, and good to be here, is just a hint of a tango playing away there. And we're playing the music because the book that I'm going to be talking about, The Tango War, with author Mary Jo McConaughey, is far from the music, but connected to the music. It is about the struggle for the hearts, minds, riches of Latin America during the Second World War, during World War II. So Mary Jo McConaughey, welcome to the studio here.
Thank you, lovely to be here.
And I think one way of introducing your book, which I found very helpful, was actually in that opening paragraph. So maybe we could start with you reading a section at the beginning of the book.
At a cafe on the Tiergartenstrasse, women meet over Black Forest cake and Apfelstrudel, planning a film night for their chapter of the NS Frauenschaft, the Nazi Women's League. Outside the cafe, girls in pinafores and boys wearing Lederhosen pass the wide windows, returning from the Neue Deutsche Schule. Some of the youngsters look up to the sky in hopes of catching sight of the Zepp, the silver dirigible Graf Zeppelin, passing overhead. Newspaper vendors hawk the Deutsches Volksblatt. And in an empty lot, very young boys wearing swastikas on armbands practice marching under the tutelage of teens from the Nazi Youth Club and the Gymnastic Society. Hitler's birthday is just around the corner. There will be parades. The party men will march in their uniform shirts, arms raised straight out before them, saluting like the Führer. These moments on a Tiergartenstrasse might be unfolding in 1930s Germany, but instead, the afternoon scene is typical of a host of towns in southern Brazil, where a million ethnic Germans lived on the eve of World War II. Ethnic Italians and Japanese, too, resided in countries from Mexico to Argentina.
Yeah, I think that's really an incredible scene because you do, at the beginning, definitely feel you're in Germany in the 1930s. And in fact, this book is nowhere near Germany. It's about South America, Latin America, Central America. And the scene you described, in fact, is in Brazil. And I think a lot of people may have been unaware that on the eve of World War II, this huge immigrant populations from Germany, from Italy, and Japan were mingled in with the local community. So let's talk a little bit about what you might have experienced had you been one of these ethnic groups living in South America in 1939.
Right. Well, the Japanese often worked in agriculture, many along the Amazon. Brazil was very much a destination for Japanese. By the time of the war, of course, you'd have second or third generation Japanese, so they were quite Brazilian, many of them. Germans also worked in agriculture. Southern Brazil counted 1 million Germans. That's just in southern Brazil, one pocket of Latin America. Mm-hmm. And they were quite prominent in the various cities. The Italians were fewer and much more assimilated almost immediately, you could say, because their culture, their religion was so much closer to that of Latin America.
So this all gave birth to a network of spies. And of course, from the American point of view, one of the founders of the OSS, Wild Bill Donovan, was alert to this. And part of your story covers how Americans coped as war progressed with spying and espionage in South America.
Right. Well, I think the members of that community would not be saying that their communities gave birth to the spies. In fact, that's what they were suspected of. But mind you, many of these families were as rooted in these countries as people who had lived there for many, many, many generations. Nevertheless, they were highly suspect by the United States, especially by J. Edgar Hoover, who had the hegemony over espionage groups in Latin America. His FBI was the only espionage agency allowed to operate in Latin America. So the OSS, which is the forerunner, of course, of the CIA, run by Wild Bill Donovan, had to play some very, very clever tricks in order to get his men down there to spy and to do counter-espionage.
And, of course, Wild Bill Donovan didn't play by the rules. In fact, you have a section on kidnapping and hostage-taking.
Right. In fact, Wild Bill Donovan didn't have anything to do with this program of hostage taking. That was something completely different. It was run by the State Department, and I call it the original extraordinary rendition. That is thousands of Latin American legal residents and citizens were kidnapped. Operation Safe Passages, it was called, to use in exchange for Americans caught behind lines, entire families. In fact, I've met survivors of these families right here in San Francisco. Entire families were brought to a concentration camp in Crystal City, Texas, to await hostage exchanges. Some of them never saw their grandparents again, for instance.
Now, in case you, as a listeners, I think we're talking about today, we're actually talking about the Tango War, and the period we're looking at is from 1939 to 1945. And I think what is interesting about this is the impact that the media had, the radio, filmmakers, and you do have a section on John Ford and how he was alerted to different aspects of espionage.
Well, John Ford was a member of the Naval Reserve in the Southern California section years before the war. And he started to suspect that some of the fishing companies, the Japanese fishing companies, were in fact fronts for spying. And he was a commission, more or less, to keep an eye on what was going on. And he Wild Bill Donovan became great friends. They were both Irish Catholics. They had that mystique. John Ford drank and Wild Bill Donovan didn't, but everything else about them was on the same trail. And John Ford started taking film and taking pictures, making documentaries, and spying for the OSS.
So all this sense of intrigue is here in the pages of the Tango War. And Mary Jo, you've just been down in Mexico. Where were you?
This time I just happened to be in Puebla, which is in central Mexico. And I usually spend a lot more of my time down in the south, in the rainforest area, or in Mexico City. Puebla is an old colonial city. It was built, in fact, so that the first conquerors would feel at home. And it looks to me, I mean, I wasn't around then, but it looks to me that it couldn't have changed for 400 years.
And your previous book actually covered the rainforests in South Mexico, is that right?
Right, South Mexico and Guatemala. And just like the Amazon, of course, there's less and less of it all the time. During the war, of course, the big rubber campaign, the rubber soldiers who went in and harvested for the United States and ultimately for the Allies, that incredibly important resource, opened up the Amazon to development, and it hasn't stopped.
Now, if you want to follow more about this book, it is wonderful narrative history, the title, The Tango War. Mary Jo, you're going to be doing some readings, and where is your next couple of readings coming up? Are you going to be in Sausalito?
Yes, I will be in Sausalito on the 26th of September. I'm really looking forward to it. It's a dream place for an author to read. And my website for the Tango War, it's www.tangowar.com, gives several other locations where I'll be reading.
So you're going to be at Book Passage on the 26th, talking about the Tango War, and people can also reach you on your website. Do you want to give that website out one more time?
Yes, it's www.tangowar.com, and there's a wonderful little video on there to get you acquainted with the book.
Good, good. Thank you for coming in today.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mary Jo, and thank you, Peter, for that interesting segment on the tango. Coming to a local library near you, hopefully, and if not, why not go to your local bookstore to pick up a copy of The Tango Wars. This has been Open Air here on Local Public Radio. Thanks to Neil Swinkels for producing the show. Among the topics next week, I'll be talking with Martin Segelke of the San Francisco Wind Ensemble. We'll be talking with folks from the San Francisco Playhouse as well. Part of the highlights of next week's Open Air. Hope you can be with us.